This is Fresh Air. This is America's first war since Vietnam, but the Iraqis just ended an 8-year war with Iran in 1988. It was a war that resulted in more than 1 million casualties. Experts are looking at the Iran-Iraq war for clues to Saddam Hussein's strategy in this war. Charles Tripp is the co-author of Iran and Iraq at War, and he teaches at London University's School of Oriental and African Studies. He spoke with me earlier today from the NPR Bureau in London. I asked him what kind of military training Saddam Hussein has.
He has none. He's promoted himself to the rank of field marshal, but he's never served in the military. The reason he is where he is really at the moment is because, of course, his uncle, General Bakr, was a military man, much trusted within the armed forces, and a great military conspirator. And he came to power, Saddam Hussein came to power, more or less on the coattails, as it were, of his uncle's military political expertise.
Did he get rid of his uncle so he could grab more power himself?
Almost certainly. I think that what one saw, Saddam Hussein became president officially of Iraq in 1979. But really, by the early 1970s, by about 1973, Saddam Hussein had more or less eliminated everybody who might be a challenge to him within the Ba'ath Party, which was his main stronghold, and so had become increasingly influential within the regime, trusted by his uncle, the president, and increasingly taking on most of the major responsibilities. By 79, when his uncle was persuaded to resign as president, to retire, he was effective number one. I think there's no doubt about it, the fact that Saddam Hussein persuaded his uncle to retire as president. And there's a strong suspicion that when his uncle died in 1982, this was not a death simply due to natural causes.
How did Saddam Hussein protect himself during the Iran-Iraq war? And what would that lead you to guess about how he's protecting himself now?
Well, how he protected himself politically is one question, and how he protected himself, as it were, physically is another. On the second, I think it's very difficult for me to comment in any detail, simply because I don't know enough. I think that from what one gathers of reports, there is an extraordinarily complex and some would say almost paranoid, but in the Iraqi context, probably quite sensible, system of protection of the person of the president. But the political protection is perhaps the more important question. And two things one saw him doing during that war. One was to try and convince all those around him that if he was to fall, they would all fall as well. And this was relatively easy to do while the Iranians were demanding the establishment of an Islamic Republic in Iraq. That is, it was not difficult to persuade the existing elite that the Iranians had no place for them either. But the other way he did it was, of course, a way which he's tried really more or less since his first ascendancy into power, which was to make sure that in most of the trusted positions, he had relatives, kinsmen, members of his clan, members of his tribe, and one or two selected, trusted individuals who are more or less his creatures.
Are there disadvantages of surrounding yourself with family?
Well, yes, I think that one may see it in the case of Saddam Hussein. One, a more specific one, is that obviously if you favor your own family, you tend to exclude all the others, or at least you tend to exclude other clans, other networks, other kin groups. And many of them can begin to resent it. And unless you're very able, the chances are that there will be a kind of coalition of tribes, of clans, of families against you. This is something Saddam Hussein, a danger which he's always had to run, and to some extent he's managed to avoid it. But I think the other question, which has obviously seems to have come up in the light of this crisis, is the fact that when you surround yourself with your kinsmen, your clan, you have around you people whose outlook is more or less exactly the same as your own. So the problem is that if you're trying to judge the outside world's reactions, the larger strategic question, you have nobody sufficiently distanced from that inner circle to be able to give you, as it were, an objective assessment. And I think one may have seen the results of that in this slide into war, which has been taking place since the invasion of Kuwait.
Does Tariq Aziz, who is the Iraqi figure that Americans have seen most of, in addition to Saddam Hussein, does Tariq Aziz fit into the picture that you've drawn us of Saddam Hussein surrounding himself with people from his hometown and from his family?
Well, I think that the great thing about Tariq Aziz is that, of course, he comes from a very small minority community, the Christians, in Iraq, and therefore is no kind of threat to Saddam Hussein. I did not mean to imply that Saddam Hussein has exclusively surrounded himself by his family. He's been quite careful in occasionally promoting people from the Kurdish community, from the Shia community, and Tariq Aziz's case, of course, from the Christian community, as his personal creatures. But I think one of the things one must remark about Tariq Aziz, he would not be where he was today, was it not for the patronage of Saddam Hussein. And in that sense, Saddam Hussein can be totally reliant upon him, or believes he can be, because Tariq Aziz has nowhere else to go. He is regarded by his own community as being a creature of Saddam Hussein, by other Iraqis as being not only a creature of Saddam Hussein, but a Christian from a minority who has a power which many Iraqis might resent. And in that sense, he's quite isolated in, if you like, the close embrace of Saddam Hussein himself.
Historian Charles Tripp in a conversation recorded earlier today. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Charles Tripp is my guest, and he teaches at London University's School of Oriental and African Studies. He's also the co-author of a book about the Iran-Iraq War. We've been watching the videotapes of the Americans who were taken prisoner of war by the Iraqis. It's been really horrifying to watch that. What kind of track record did Iraq have in terms of how they treated Iranian prisoners of war during the Iran-Iraq War?
I don't know in detail, but again, one has heard anecdotal evidence for some fairly brutal treatment. Brutal treatment really in a kind of callous way. I don't think necessarily picked out for particular persecution in the sense they say a political prisoner in Iraq would be, but just in the way that they were neglected, not really looked after, not properly treated, until it became important for the Iraqi government to demonstrate its good behavior to the Red Cross. And of course, as the Iraqis increasingly relied on an international effort to support them, that was more and more important. So after 1983, things did tend to get better for the Iranian prisoners. But I think one aspect of the Iranian prisoners, which again has been very important within Iraq, is to display them to the people. And I think perhaps this is the key to what one has seen on Iraqi television. That is, it's no good taking prisoners, as far as the Iraqi government is concerned, unless you can show the people of Iraq that you have done so, and you show them in relatively humiliating circumstances. You parade them either in the backs of lorries through the town or on television screens, so to give the people some tangible evidence that their side is winning.
So you think that the tapes really weren't meant for Americans to watch, but rather for Iraqis to see?
Oh, I think there could be a double purpose in this. I think that throughout the crisis, from really August the 2nd, one of the attempts by Saddam Hussein has been to influence opinion in the West, and particularly, of course, to undermine the will to fight. And he's made a great deal of play of that in his propaganda about the fact that the West would never go to war because nobody could possibly sustain the idea of fighting in the West. And I think one saw that in the case of the hostages until he released them. One's seen that in the tone of his propaganda. And quite clearly, I think the display of prisoners speaking in their own language on television is part of this particular belief by Saddam Hussein that it will somehow influence opinion in the West against the war.
You know, one thing we've all been wondering in America is how come Saddam Hussein hasn't deployed the Air Force yet? And I was reading your book on the Iran-Iraq War, and there's a very interesting quote from Saddam Hussein that he made in 1980. He said, "We will not use our Air Force. We will keep it 2 years. Hence, our Air Force will be in a position to pound Bani Sadr and his collaborators." What might that indicate about his strategy today and why he hasn't deployed the Air Force yet?
Well, there might be a parallel in this. I think one has to be quite cautious at the moment because, after all, the war is less than a week old, and one doesn't quite know what the operational or military reasons, although one can guess at them, for the problems of the Air Force. Obviously, in military operational terms, there's the problem of knowing to what extent the Iraqi Air Force can counter the kind of air power which the coalition has deployed over Iraq. There's the problem of the runways. There may even be the problem, for all one knows, of kerosene, of jet fuel, for which there were reported shortages earlier on. But politically, I think there is a couple of interesting points which might be thought of. The first is, rather as in the Iran-Iraq War, the belief that as long as Iraq can withstand the attack, it must have something in reserve with which to produce a victory at the end. And this goes very much, I think, with the mentality almost of the Scud missiles. That is a kind of wonder weapon which will produce a victory out of the unexpected apparent defeat of Iraq. But there's also another reason, which I don't know whether it's the one that plays on his mind at the moment, is the memory of the part that the Air Force has played in previous coup d'etat in Iraq and the mistrust with which he regards the Air Force as a political instrument, largely because he cannot be sure that the people who are good pilots are necessarily loyal Saddam Hussein supporters. And I think this has always been his dilemma. It's been the dilemma of other presidents and dictators in the Middle East as well. But I think that this is the problem, that you can put your tribesmen in the army, but it's very difficult to make them into very good pilots and then to trust them.
You mean because for a pilot, you really need somebody who's very well-trained and is very smart about the technology. You can't just put anybody because they're related to you in that position.
Absolutely. I mean, in order to master the kind of technology you need for modern aerial warfare, you do need people who have a very strong grounding in education. And the chances are in Iraq that these sort of people will come from the educated middle classes, the professional classes of Baghdad, Basra, and so forth. These are not the countrymen of Saddam Hussein. These are not the people from the little villages around Tikrit, the people who would otherwise be agricultural laborers or whatever.
You've said that during the Iran-Iraq war that Saddam Hussein tried to personalize the war as a struggle between the individual rulers of Iraq and Iran. I wonder if you see a parallel in that today, in terms of how Saddam Hussein and George Bush talk about the wars.
Oh, well, the way in which Saddam Hussein certainly tries to portray the war, I think it's very important that he does personalize it. But it's not simply a strategy. I think it tells you something about the way he looks at power. I think as far as Saddam Hussein is concerned, power is worthless unless he has personal absolute control of it in Iraq. And so, as one has seen through the cult of personality and the extraordinarily centralized form of command in Iraqi politics, he's done everything he possibly could to ensure that he himself, as the dictator of Iraq, has supreme power. And so in the war against Iran, what he wanted to try and portray, I think, to many Iraqis, was not only that Saddam Hussein was, as it were, protecting them against the rampaging Iranians, but curiously, in a different shift, trying to claim that the Iranians were misled, that they were possibly good Muslims, but they had a madman at their head. And one could see the same kind of rationale taking place in his view of the West, and indeed of the other Arab countries. That is, that if only they were allowed to express themselves, the peoples of the West, the peoples of the Arab countries would all be on Saddam Hussein's side, and it's only their mad leaders which prevent them from expressing themselves and who are determined to prosecute the war against Iraq. So it's partly his way of explaining this war to his people, partly possibly also a kind of vain attempt at subversion beyond his borders, and also possibly tells you something about the way he looks at power.
Now, isn't George Bush personalizing the war, too, in the sense that he's always describing Saddam Hussein as the equivalent of Hitler? We have nothing against the Iraqi people, but Saddam Hussein is a vicious tyrant. Do you think George Bush is also personalizing the war, or do you think he's personalizing it for completely different reasons?
I think he's personalizing it for different reasons. I think that the downside, if you like, of what Saddam Hussein's personalization of power has been is that, of course, he has made it so that he is responsible for everything that happens in Iraq. And therefore, when people look at it from the outside, there's quite clearly an accurate assessment that what Saddam Hussein says goes. And in that sense, the Allies are probably not wrong in personalizing the war. If one can imagine a change of regime in Iraq, one really only has to imagine the removal of Saddam Hussein. And I think as far as the coalition is concerned, they are quite accurate, if you like, in targeting him. So I don't think there's a symmetry, but there's obviously a connection between the two.
Charles Stribb, if you don't mind my asking this, does this war make sense to you?
Well, unfortunately, on one level, it certainly does. That is, on the level of Iraqi politics. I think that the decision to invade Kuwait was very much a product of what had been happening in Iraq up to that period, since the end of the Iran-Iraq war. And the miscalculations, which you like, if you like, which led to the outbreak of war, or at least to the unexpected, I believe, as far as Saddam Hussein was concerned, of the outbreak of war on the 16th of January, was very much part and parcel of the way things have been conducted in Iraq, regardless for the moment of what the outside pressures, motives, and so forth were. So what one saw was many ways the intransigence of the Iraqi regime, and to some extent the self-delusion. And I think that those are two very dangerous attitudes with which to approach negotiations when war is the possible outcome. So from the Iraqi point of view, or from the point of view of Saddam Hussein, although I don't think it was inevitable, it was certainly a very strong possibility indeed.
Charles Tripp, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Historian Charles Tripp, he's the co-author of Iran and Iraq at War. This is Fresh Air.